On to the regular agenda items. Item five, very important presentation. This is going to be a presentation on the annual benefit KE well check process. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Be sure that mic is on and close to you.
I'm sorry, you guys, yep, it's on, okay.
Yeah, you might want to pull that a little closer to you, just.
Sorry, I'm just waiting for the slides, yep. And while we get there, so this is, as you said, the a presentation on our annual well check, which is basically a process we go through annually to look at populations that might be considered at risk for us to verify correct payment and essentially that they're still at the same address, that they're alive and well. There's a multitude of reasons, but the main reason is correct payment to people at their correct address. So we'll cover topics on the timelines that we do the project in, as well as what's required for completion, and then also how we identify the population that we're going to send notices to or reach out to, our follow-up process, and then there's some other stuff as well involved in things like returned mail, closed record states that we have to deal with in the process, as well as members who we don't get a response from.
This is when you need that overhead projector. You can do some slides and riff a little bit. This is a graphic depiction of the signal. This may be the most quiet I've ever heard. There's no pressure.
Am I still going to be able to use this? Great. All right, so we covered this slide. So starting with timelines. So in May of each year, we start to determine the group that we want to send notices to, which we, for this year, we've already started. The process is typically handled by two staff in our retiree unit, the two technicians. Then once we've identified that population, we send them notices, their first notice in June, which will happen in the next week or two. These notices consist of a letter explaining the process and then also a form for the payee to complete, which is part of verifying them. So the form itself, they fill it out and then it's required to get notarized and then return with a copy of a valid government ID. We send, throughout the whole process, we send the first the initial notice. If we need to, we'll send a follow-up. And then if we need to, we will send a final notice. And that typically runs us through roughly October. They typically do it in about a 6 to 8 week interval. So completing the form, as I mentioned, they submit it notarized and with a copy of their photo ID. It can also be completed by an attorney in fact, or a power of attorney, or a conservator if necessary, but still does require to be notarized. A different possibility is if the payee themselves is essentially disabled and not able to complete the form, they're not able to get to a notary, that kind of thing, it can be submitted with a doctor's note that doesn't require notarization. So it has to be usually within a tight window, so roughly a month or two of us having sent the letter, so it has to be recent, from a doctor that they've seen and that we can verify.
So and I think you've probably already said this in the context, but we don't have a rule or a requirement that our retirees notify us, for instance, if they have a durable power of health care, or they have an attorney in fact, or in other words, we don't know when we send out the well check who's actually going to respond. Is that fair?
Well, we know if they have one on record with us already. We do find out about new power of attorney through the well check. That's not it's not like a massive population or a group out of that group, but yes, it does happen in this process that we find out about new power of attorney or new conservator, or as we'll get to, you know, they have a new address, that kind of stuff. Do we have a policy that they need to notify us about power of attorney? I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head, that they have to notify us.
Okay. No, you answered the question. Thank you.
You know, one part that's not on here that we have done in the past that we've used to verify people is, we did this last year, we had a member who was 100 and had a expired ID, had no intention of getting a new driver's license, and they lived in the area, so they came into the office and we just basically verified their record. That's what they wanted to do. And we do that, that's it, essentially at management's discretion, that they can come in or we can find an alternative method like that. But that's very rare. I think we've done that twice over the last 3 years. So how we choose to determine the population we're going to send it to, we do look at risk. We do a risk analysis on the populations, and that's typically things that are involved are age, their residency location, it can be their benefit amount, and also their last contact with CICERA. We typically get down to a population of approximately 200 people each year that we're sending these initial notices out to. Some examples we've done last year, we did the group included members over the age of 85 that had not changed their address since retirement. So some of these were same address and we hadn't received any communication back and forth between them in the last 5 years, so that we could identify a population that we hadn't had any contact with recently.
Is that the sort of way you approach it every year, just something a little bit different in how you select?
That's a good question. So typically we try to not, if we go through different categories, we try not to send notices to the exact same people every year. So typically they're on kind of a biannual basis, unless there's reason to do it more often. So when we pull up a category, yeah, like we usually start with some basic stuff, age, and again, we're going to get into it, but close state is a pretty common one for us if they live, you know, essentially outside of California. Some other categories that we might look at are things like whether or not they have health deductions, things like that, that would help us if we essentially have, I guess, less of a lead to find them without alternative methods, then they're typically going to pop up on our list more often. So as I said before, we typically send out the initial notice. At that point, there's approximately about 65% of the members are verified. They've reached back, they filled out the form, and we're fine with them. If we haven't, the other group that we haven't heard from, after about 6 weeks, we send out a follow-up notice, and typically after that point, we're through about 80% of the group. Then with what's, and again, what I would say is there's typically contact before we even get to a final notice. So a lot of members do call and they'll ask for an extension or they'll submit paperwork and it's incomplete. So they, what's typical is we get the form and no ID, or we get an ID and no form, and we will reach back at that point and let them know there's still documentation that we need. Once we get to a point where we're going to do a final notice and we've essentially sent out two notices with no return mail, no contact back, at that point, staff's reaching out to them by phone. If they're a member and have a beneficiary, we'll try to reach out to them as well. We also will do an address verification with our third-party vendor, which usually includes a death search as well. We can also reach out to other entities, which we've done. So we've reached out to banks in the past. We've also used our employers to help us verify if they have health deductions, if they are active with them. Sometimes they can give me any new addresses that they've reported to their health insurance, or sometimes I can get last usage, so I can know, you know, they'll be able to tell us if they've used their actual dental coverage or health insurance in the last 6 months, essentially. So it gives us a pretty good idea that they're, you know, still around and either just not responding or we need to dig deeper. So we get to the final notice. Again, we do send, that notice does say, you know, this process requires your response. Otherwise, if we don't hear from you, we have to essentially put your benefits in the suspense. It usually gives them a 6 week time frame as well. And again, at that point, we end up with approximately 95% that come back. As an example for last year, after we did the process, we had four people that we put in suspense who we got no response from. And that happened in, I believe it was October or November. Two of them have since reached out and we've reinstated them and they're back in pay. And then two of them remain suspended that we haven't been able to find yet. And again, as it says up here, you know, when we don't receive that response, we put them in suspense or we will redirect their check to the office depending on what their scenario is, which I'll give a little bit more detail around in a second. Until we reach them, and then we essentially make them whole at that point once we've reached them, as far as their payments are concerned. Since I brought it up, as far as suspense and redirection, so for county, for instance, if they have health insurance, we typically redirect their check to us. So we print them a check and hold on to it so that their deductions are still being paid in case. I guess what we're trying to avoid is someone who is in fact using that health insurance and very much needs it, that they're not being cut off because of not being able to be located, but we're not also continuing to pay somebody we haven't found. If they have no deductions, then typically we just suspend that payment because we can just reinstate it and pay them back what they're due at that point. So some additional considerations. This is a return mail is an ongoing process we do throughout the year, but it does come up during our well check. So if we receive returned mail, the first thing we do is staff will reach out to the payee by a phone call, typically. Again, if they're a member and they have a beneficiary, we'll reach out to the beneficiary to try to locate that payee or that member. We also do run location, try to search for a location with our third-party vendors. And again, if we need to, we'll run a death check. And again, if we're unable to reach them by these contacts, we do either suspend or redirect their payment, just as we, you know, just discussed with the will check. So this, again, like I said, is an ongoing process, happens throughout the year. And typically there's, you know, one or two that will go all the way through this process, get suspended, and then they turn up, and then we end up reinstating them. So closed states. So there are quite a few states in the U.S. that do not release records publicly for us to be able to assist us in determining whether or not they've passed away and things like that. So currently, as of our May 1st payroll, we had 1,394 payees out of our just over 11,000 that are in closed states. And as you can see on the slide, from that group, 120 of them are over 85, and 8 of them are over 95. We, as far as their sort of average benefit, I did look into that. It's a little bit lower than the rest of our population. It's about, you know, $1,500 or so lower than what we pay in the other ones. Now, that's, again, kind of a factor we do factor in. But this is typically a group it says 3 years, but we, the group of eight were part of our verification in 23, and then they're part of the verification this year. And typically we're kind of moving to that population being almost on an annual basis. They also, as we put up there, they represent the highest risk, and unfortunately California is surrounded by closed states. So Oregon, Arizona, Idaho, Utah, they're all closed states. The only one near us that's open is Washington. But with that being said, still the majority of our population is in an open state where we generally get all the information we need to verify them.
Is there any statistical standard or criteria that are used to determine the size of the check? It's 200, right? 200 retirees?
That we verify on an annual basis, you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, you're saying, do we average out what their payment is for any sort of?
No, the number of cases people you sample in an age group or in a category. It's 200 retirees.
Yes.
So that's less than 2% of the retired population, right?
Correct, except we're already, in reality, we're already filtering down to even get to that 200. So, for example, you know, California is open. We have about 9,000 payees that are still being paid in California. So that already, for our purposes, kind of represents a lower risk population because we're going to get those records from state of California or Social Security or our third party vendor, generally speaking. So not that we never send the letters to people in California, because we definitely do. But then we're using a lot of things to try to determine risk to get to hopefully what is our higher risk populations for this. I don't know if that, does that answer your
question? No, I was just trying to get a feel for whether some statistician said it's a meaningful sample to take 2% of the retiree population within a given classification, and that's relevant. So if you break it down, though, we have, what, 10,200-some-odd retirees, maybe more now. It might be a little dated.
A little over 11,000.
Yeah. And so of that total, you know, there's a more finite group that fits the age filters, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it sounds like we take a much higher percentage of the targeted groups, right, that are,
yeah.
So, and I'm just wondering if there was any particular standard we were trying to match, or we were told, oh, you need to do that.
We're trying to hit, let's say, like 15% of that population on an annual basis. I guess we haven't approached it exactly in that term. We're trying to hit a meaningful number that will catch what we consider at risk, but we haven't put a percentage on it that way, I would say. But yeah, I mean, to your point, like in 24, we basically did payees over a certain age outside of California. So in reality, if we did 200 of them, there's about 2,000 people being paid outside of California. So that was about roughly a 20% hit rate there.
Right, and out of that 2,000, were all those in closed states or a portion of them?
No, they were both. Yeah, so there's only a little over 600 people that are outside of California in an open state. So the population is definitely smaller, but that's because there's fewer open states than there are closed, unfortunately.
Maybe in addition, because I know we're talking about the Alive and Well process and this annual process that we do, but maybe talk about what we do monthly as well.
Yeah, so with our third-party vendors, we have a location and a death match that happens on a monthly basis. So we, our population of 11,000 is actually ran securely through a third-party vendor that we are contracted to, who then is verifying for any death match that come up. That actually comes up on a weekly basis, but we give them our population after we pay each month because of people who come on and come off, so that it's an accurate population for them. And they're doing those death match, those death matches on a weekly basis and returning to them, them to us. So that's on top of things like a family member calling us, or if, you know, an employer tells us, or if we get a response back from health deduction sometimes. So the bank files come back to us with returned payments because the account holder is deceased. So there's more than just the well check that we do is not the only part that we do once a year to verify whether or not, you know, people are obviously still alive and should be receiving benefits. It's just a way that we look at particular categories to make sure that we're doing an extra check. But yes, it's a good point. Sorry. On a weekly and monthly basis, there is this death match that happens through our providers.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. I mean, in terms of that, that's an ongoing program, right? That's important.
Do we know how thorough the vendors are? Are they simply doing a database scrub, or are they? I mean, for those that are flagged, are they hiring private investigators when all other options are exhausted?
Generally, no. I mean, they're verifying against different points of data, right? So they're looking for everything from an obituary to the Social Security death match files that are made, that can be made public to them. They deal with some of the struggles that we do with closed states as well.
Yeah, I mean, because you did bring up the closed state, closed states. So I'm just wondering what other options these vendors have other than phone calls and, sending out forms. What other options they go through to try and verify?
Yeah, I mean, they have similar limitations to what we have. So, and we are in the process of actually taking on potentially a second one that we're basically using that as a way to try to test thoroughness between multiple vendors to see if we get different information or more accurate between, you know, different vendors. I mean, it is, what we're doing is generally what every system is doing. I've had those conversations with other systems, as Christine and Colin I'm sure have in the past, to see what the standard is and where we're at it. But we're moving towards potentially having more than one vendor again to kind of see if there's a different essentially hit rate based on the data that they're able to collect. So again, for an open state, for instance, they can check, you know, the death match files from Social Security. They can typically get death certificate reports or sometimes medical reports. And some of that is generally not available in a closed state unless the actual person themselves has made it public. So yes, they're still generally kind of dealing with similar issues.
I also had a question. I'm just kind of wondering, because yeah, this makes sense as a highest risk group because of advanced age, but I was thinking another pretty high risk could be people who earn a lot, like basically who have a pretty high retirement and live in closed states or outside of the country and relatively young, because people die at any age, right? So, and if we don't catch those, it could be just one person, but the hit on the fund could be the same as 10 people who make less. So Do we check any way we check those or not?
We do, yeah. So again, we did everyone in a foreign country. We did that in 24, so we're up for that pretty soon here too. And again, we did that at a pretty low, generally a low age, so 65. And actually, in that example, we did have somebody who we had already had returned mail and had suspended them, and then we did end up finding out they were deceased, but we had already been suspending them for 3 months. So they passed away 3 months after we had started suspending them because we couldn't get a hold of them, and that money was then later, you know, paid onto their estate. But yes, we do also do out of country, and again, we do look at benefit amount. I guess it is a factor, but I think it's more, again, us trying to reach out to people that are not easily, as opposed to the dollar amount being the main factor, it's more about the ease of access.
And those high dollar amounts, especially if they're in California, which is where we see them usually stay, they're going through that every week check to see if a death has been reported. So those ones get picked up much faster. This is really focused on those ones that really are in the close states, that higher age, maybe have for that higher risk area. So we have other things that go on through the year, but this is really, this process here is where we're really trying to target those really high risk people.
Are any of the vendors working in this space targeting the closed states market, if you will, with, you know, AI applications or things to try to peel back the veneer to get at the data because the states don't share that information?
So I think there are some vendors that would claim to be doing that potentially, but whether or not, I mean, I've heard mixed messages from the other systems that I've had conversations with as to how successful that's been. So yes, there are some that kind of claim they can get stuff in closed states, and we have had conversations with some of those and discussed them, but the overall consensus that I always get from other systems is it's mixed to their success level.
It sounds like this is kind of a black box technology, you know, like a sealed box. You don't really know how it works, but you're told it might do this or that.
Well, I mean, they're basically doing a much bigger record search than we would be capable to do on a week-to-week basis. And they're, you know, again, as with most things, what they claim and can deliver is not always the same. And we really can only verify that against the results we get.
All right.
Thank you.
Just a quick.
Yes.
Okay. You indicate that at least one third of the specific group, 1,394, 1,400, I think, are sent out each year. One third of the 400 plus, you send out 200. Why? What am I missing here?
I'm sorry. I'm. Can you state it again? I didn't totally understand.
Yes, you indicate that one third of the 1,400 in closed states are sent out annually, and that would be somewhere in the range of 400 plus. And yet you indicate that only 200 are looked at each year. What am I missing?
I'm not sure where the one third is coming from.
This group is considered the highest and therefore is included in the well checked population once every 3 years.
Yeah, so at least every 3 years we're getting through. Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. If we're not doing 400, how are we getting through the whole group? So we're doing essentially a sample of the population at least every third year, if not more. But that's not, we're doing roughly 200 as we filter them down into what we consider the highest risk out of that 1,394 people. So it's not that we're doing 400 or that we're doing one third each year. It's that we are hitting, we are sending letters to this population at least once every 3 years, and we're picking a group of 200 that we've essentially narrowed down. So the group itself is changing. So whoever, if we, let's say we pick a, I don't know, over 85 living in closed states, that group changes over 3 years. So the 1394 isn't exactly like a stable number year to year. It's changing. So the 200 that we're choosing to cycle through is also changing in that group. So we're not necessarily picking one third of it.
I'm not sure I follow that, but it just gets,
reduced down because sending a form is like the final step. We also look, have we had any contact with them? So in that group, that's where we start. They're our highest risk group. So every year we're looking at that, and then we're breaking it down further.
I guess it strikes me that you're actually going to more than 200.
Each year we,
yes.
The actual form that gets sent as the part of this process, like I mentioned before, that's like our highest risk ones, but every year we're going to more than 200, but it could be in different ways. It could be through their healthcare. It could be through communication that we've had. It could be through address verification and changes. It could be banking changes that we're getting through the bank. So all of that is happening. And then we're getting down to really this, what we consider the highest risk of around 200, where we've had no response, nothing, then we're sending out this mailing and requiring notarization.
So this is, everything else didn't produce a result, so you're left with that.
Yes, so this is really getting us to what we consider our highest risk and what we need to do an even greater check on, where we're requiring a notarization and actual contact and confirmation of that person.
Okay. Sorry, I apologize. I guess I hadn't made that clear yet. So it's a good point. As an example, you know, if we had somebody call us last month and they were going to be on this list, but we had what we consider a totally valid communication with them, a phone and a form that we verified, and we felt this meets all the requirements for us to know this person's still alive and well, that we don't necessarily need to include them in our 200 group for this month, since we just had a communication within essentially 30 days in that example. So it does get narrowed down in that respect. So yes, we are essentially having communication with more than 200 people out of this population, but it ends up becoming somewhere around 200 people that we're actually sending this notice out to, because we haven't had a communication like that and they still meet the other risk factors we're going through.
Jared, do you have a comment?
I have a question. Perhaps being overly optimistic about the added interest, or the renewed interest there seems to be on fraud, the subject of fraud nationally. And I keep thinking that maybe that will actually well up in various states, and you will actually refute discount Minnesota, which currently has a policy against any of us to button down fraud. But is there any consideration, or I guess more importantly, doing good to try and coordinate the efforts of associations in California, including maybe in CalPERS, and seeing if we could bring some outside pressure on those states to suggest to them how difficult this is for them, and the fact is for us, and the fact that it's probably difficult for other states as well, and see if we could generate some interest. I mean, it's out of state, I'm sure they could say go count sand, but the other plans can't be any happier about this than we are, and CalPERS either.
No, they're not, but unfortunately, I think it's a state by state issue that has to be essentially voted in by constituent. So it would have to be the equivalency of a proposition on the ballot that we would have here in California, that the voters say we want it to be in an open record state now. So
California is open, so hopefully yes. Don't see anything changing that.
Yeah, of course. I just mean they would have to have a proposition of some kind put on their ballot that the voters then say, as a whole, we want the state now to be an open record state, which
I don't like get drilled down too deeply, but somehow that suggests to me that it could be done by legislative action as well. It wouldn't necessarily require a vote by people. If you could convince some group of legislators that this makes some sense. And do they support the idea of not being able to ferret out fraud and how few there might be?
I mean, I guess that is possible. Yeah, I think it would. I don't totally know. I would guess that would depend on what the legislative framework is in state by state. But there unfortunately isn't really like a what would qualify under sort of a federal action to just sort of blanket and make it across the country. That they would have to be a state by state action.
So that's what I was thinking. The easier, not easier, but the direct solution is to federalize it, right? If Congress passed a law and the president signed it that all states are required to have open records with respect to death or whatever else, that becomes the law of the land, I think. Of course, our Supreme Court might have something to say about it, but assuming they bless that, that would be the law of the land. Right? Yeah.
Doesn't feel likely that the Fed's going to put that on their agenda anytime soon.
Just a quick question. Am I correct that the experience we have in this area, whether it be losses associated with people who got away with several months or a few months or whatever of cash and checks, that folds into our experience study, does it not?
Yes.
So we account for that in our actuarial calculation of the fund, right?
Correct.
I'm not saying that's the answer to it, but at least we're accounting for it. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Is this my, this one? Okay, sorry. The last slide is essentially mostly a summarization of what we've talked about so far. So again, you know, if we can't get a hold of them, we're going to either suspend or redirect. We will, for those that we redirect a payment to us, they're still having their taxes and their deductions withheld while we go through investigating and trying to find them. the process typically starts sometime, it can start within 6 months or earlier, depending on what we find out, but the 6 months is kind of allowing for us to get through our whole well check process, and then it can continue on until we find them. So as I mentioned, we have two from last year that we still haven't located. They remain in suspense, and they will until we either find them or get a report otherwise. And again, we work with a lot of external parties. So on an annual basis, I do end up using county and some of our employers to verify health insurance and that kind of thing. We've reached out to banks before to check activity and make sure the, you know, accounts that we have on record for them are either open or still in their name, and whatever information they can provide us legally, obviously. We also have, like I said, the third party vendor who helps us with death checks on a weekly basis. And again, we're looking at adding at least a second one. And then the last part, again, the only two are the two that I've already referenced that are still as part of our investigative process. And that's the two from 25 last year that are still suspended. And with that, if there are any additional questions, please feel free.
Connie.
Unless I missed it, I was looking through our guidelines and policies. Do we have this formalized in there somewhere that I'm just not seeing with a header?
Like a
policy document that describes everything that you just put into PowerPoint form?
Yep.
Just was thinking that might be good to formalize if someone, especially thinking of some of our recent retirees that are litigious, want to say that we're harassing them or something, we can just point to, this is why we do this. We follow objective criteria to choose our sample every year, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a good point where, you know, part of our strategic plan is to actually get all of our stuff in our process and everything in writing. And so it's definitely one in there for me.
Yeah, I would second that idea. I think that this is probably something that should be structurally in our formal policies, right?
Okay.
Anybody else? All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ryan, thank you.